This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Michael Pavlich.
I'm going to talk all about the Western Front. We're joined this morning by Peter Fitzsimons, who's got a new book. It's called Fromel and Pozieres, The Trenches of Hell. Very good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's very early, isn't it? I guess you get everybody saying that, but when the alarm rings, oh, my God,
no.
People work at this time.
Come on, we're just in the middle of things. Peter, we've been going for hours here. Hey, yeah. you've attempted another look at history. You seem to plonk one out every year or so. I mean, this is a part of Australian history, 100 years, obviously. It's a good time to be talking about this. But Fromel and Pozieres, it's really extraordinary stories.
I mean, it's
the worst of the worst, isn't it? I mean, this is the worst of World War One. These are the worst battles that the Australians were involved with. So you certainly haven't mucked around. You've gone straight for the story.
Well, for me, the worst of the worst is Fromel in terms of a useless waste of life, complete slaughter. And to bear in mind, I think you're talking to me. Are you in Melbourne, I imagine?
Yep.
If you look at the MCG, I think you'd go that the MCG from one end to the other would be about, 120, 130 yards. At Fromel, the 15th Brigade, which was run by Pompey Elliott, the great Melbourne Victorian Australian general, his men, 15th Brigade, the orders were to charge 400 yards in broad daylight straight at a bunker called the Sugarloaf that had machine guns that could fire 600 bullets a minute at them. So Pompey Elliott gets the orders, you're send your men over the top, and he gets a British major, and he takes him to the spot, and he says, look at these orders, now look at this distance, broad daylight, flat ground, no cover. You want me to send my men into that? What do you think will happen to my men? And the British general says, well, I don't like to talk like that. He said, well, I'm asking you. All right, well, if you ask me, I think it'll be a bloody Holocaust. And those were the words he used, a bloody Holocaust. And Pompey Elliott says to him, well, get those orders changed. Go back to the British HQ, see if he can get the orders changed. The orders weren't changed. So that at 6:15 or 5:53 p.m. on the night of the 19th of July, 1916, the whistle blows, the Australians go over the top. And what happens? It's a bloody Holocaust. But it's beyond anything you could imagine. 7,000 Australians go over the top. They're charging. It was described as like a scything lattice work of bullets. I mean, not just bullets, but shrapnel. It was a complete slaughter. So it's like over three times the length of the MCG in broad daylight, straight at machine guns. What chance did they have? They had no chance. And 7,000 men went forward in the space of 14 hours through that evening, through the night, into the next morning. 7,000 go forward, 5,500 go down, and 1,900 men killed. More men killed in that night than were killed in the Boer War, the Vietnam War, Korea, Afghanistan, and Iraq put together. I mean, just unimaginable. And Pozieres started 3 days later. Well, I'll tell you, the next thing that got terrible was that Charles Bean arrived at the scene at 9 o'clock the next morning, and there were about 2,000 Australian men out in the middle, many of them dying. And a very brave Australian soldier went forward he got a red cushion, he cut it to pieces, and a white sheet. He made the sign of a red cross. He put it on his gun and he walked forward. And the Germans didn't shoot him. A German officer came out, and between them, they agreed they would have a truce so that to get their injured and so forth. And the Australian came back. He had to get permission from on high. The answer came back, no, we don't do truces. The British protocol was, and I'm not having a go at the British here, but I'm saying the British protocol was that having things like truces were fraternisation so that the Germans would use it as propaganda against them. No truce.
The same thing was said about when they got together over the Christmas, on Christmas Day, the two sides.
That's right. That's exactly right. That was back in Christmas Day of 1914, a famous truce. So anyway,
the powers that be weren't very happy about that. We'll come back to the English generals and their competence or incompetence, and come back to Pompey Elliott as well, because he's a bit of a character, and I wouldn't mind touching on him a little bit. But just before we do that, I mean, in Australian mythology, we hold up Gallipoli as the war that we remember or that we celebrate, I suppose, or
commemorate.
Commemorate the Western Front, in many ways, was a much more significant battle. The contribution Australia made to the Western Front, and not only that, the amount of lives lost and exactly what the troops went through. Why do you think it has taken Australia so long to sort of accept the Western Front?
Yeah, very interesting question. Is there a stigma, the Western Front, you and I, and many of our fellow Australians, you'd say the Western Front, you'd be, I think that's France, and I think that's First World War. And then you'd reel off names like Fromelles, Pozieres, Passchendaele, things like that. But what Polygon Wood, Villers Bretagne, but Australian knowledge of what it's actually about, three-fifths of bugger all, because nothing gets close to Gallipoli. I have long said that if you were to sum up what Australians know of our military past, 90%, I reckon 90% of what Australians collectively know about our military past starts at dawn on the 25th of April 1915 and fades by sundown, because we tell that story of Gallipoli again and again and again, and it excludes everything else, including things like Longtan, Tobruk, Kokoda, all of the Western Front. Nothing gets close, and I addressed that in my book on Gallipoli, why it was. And in my view, it's because when we became a federation, when we became a country, there was a feeling abroad that, okay, nominally, I guess, we're a country. Yeah, we've got a constitution like that, but we're not a real country. We're not a dinkum country until we have shed blood, that of our enemies and that of ourselves, and sacrificed to the British Empire. And when the news of Gallipoli broke on the 8th of May 1915, there was, and before I sort of half corrected you from saying celebration to say, well, we now commemorate, because we know how shocking it was. But when the news first broke of what happened at Gallipoli, it was celebration. It was, we are a country. We have done well. And our soldiers, no mistake, did do well. And they did bloody well on the Western Front. But nothing after Gallipoli ever got close to Gallipoli, because that was the moment that sort of crystallised, I believe, in the national consciousness, we are a country. And many worthy historians, of whom I am not one, I'm much more a historian than a historian, point out that, you know, it's ridiculous to think that we should have become a country at that point. Well, I agree. Absolutely ridiculous. There were so many other things that were very, very important. But when you go back to the reaction at the time, the headlines, the sermons, the dancing in the streets, effectively, well, that Gallipoli was where it all came together. We are a country. But those of our soldiers who fought both at Gallipoli and then went on to the Western Front, like Fromelles, like Pozieres, the line that they used that my researchers came across again and again and again was picnic. Gallipoli was a picnic. There was one quote from one fellow who said, I would sooner spend 12 months at Gallipoli than 12 hours here. And Charles Bean, the great war correspondent, he wrote at Pozieres, he went forward very briefly, and on the 4th of August, he wrote this account of what it was like to be in the trenches, pounded by the Germans. And it was talking about, you know, the searing, scything shrapnel coming again and again and again. And it says to the men, I will tear your flesh asunder. I will take your heads off. And this was happening to these men 10 and 20 times a minute. You know, it's a really graphic account of what it was like. And Pozieres, the Australians, the Brits, I mean, I'm doing a book, I've just finished a book now on the Battle of Villers Bretagne.
Peter, one thing that struck me is the Australians, they all went over there, it was a noble cause, they were fighting against fascism, they were fighting for a fairer world, they were fighting for the little bloke.
To be fair to the Germans, I mean, I always think that if you characterise war as good and evil, well, there's no better exemplar of evil than the Second World War, when you've got the Holocaust on one side with the Germans. So when you know that 6 million Jews were systematically executed, killed in the Second World War, well, there's no doubt where the evil lies. To be fair to the Germans in the First World War, it is not as clear-cut. There is no doubt the Germans committed atrocities as they passed through Belgium on their way into France. But beyond that, there wasn't, in my view, there wasn't systemic evil on just one side of the equation. I mean, Paul Keating, in his speech on the 11th of November 2 years ago, his line was Europe. I mean, it was along the lines of European tribalism ran amok, and his theme was that we had no part in being there. And there were the arguments on the other side that if the British Empire had collapsed in the First World War, then Germany would have taken over the likes of New Guinea. Well, Germany was already in New Guinea, but Germany would have taken over the Pacific. That we actually did have a case to be there, but the point of the First World War in recounting it is that it was the first time, before the First World War, you had industrialised nations going up against underdeveloped countries, and the First World War was the first time you had industrialised nations going up against industrialised nations with means of slaughter that the world could not imagine. And the book I've just finished on the Battle of Villers-Bretonneux, called Victory at Villers-Bretonneux, the most stunning thing for me in that, let me ask you a question, because I was stunned. I'll see if you were stunned. In that First World War, 1918, how far do you reckon the Germans, they had a gun, it was called the Paris gun. Yeah. How far do you reckon in the capability in 19 to fire a gun, how far do you reckon it could have got?
I think I read it was 30 miles.
80 miles.
Really?
I mean, they had the capacity in 1918 to send a shell 80 miles, 125 kilometres, because that's how close they got to Paris, the Germans in that First World War. They started firing on Paris 12 times a day. And so the first time a man-made object was able to leave the atmosphere and go into the stratosphere was 21st of March 1918, when they started firing on Paris. I mean, my point of that is, it's just simply unbelievable that they had that industrial capacity to kill people so far away that they had them, when they fired the gun, they had to make allowance for the curvature of the earth and the spinning of the earth.
That's incredible. I mean, there's no doubt that technology played a huge role in it. I suppose I was just trying to make the point there that a lot of the Australians did actually go over there with a noble cause, thinking they were helping the little bloke
all
out.
All of them went
the
over there. Look, you know, it was, so, there was the, it's quite stunning. I mean, you read the letters. I mean, I've just published one in The Age and The Herald a few days ago, when it was on the 4th of August. It was the 100th anniversary of the death of what happened to a man by the name of Reggio Delaney, who was already a little well-known in Australia. He was the only man to have ever knocked down Les Darcy. He was a boxer. And you read the letter on the night of the 4th of August. He wrote to his mother and saying, "Dear Mum, I'm going over the top soon. I'm sending you £18, £5 for you. The rest of it's for my wife and the two daughters, Mum. I don't know if I'm going to get back, but I know you'll look after Kit and the girls. I haven't met the little one yet, as you know. I can't wait to meet her, but look, anyway." And anyway, he writes this letter, and he goes, he ducks over the top to get a poppy to put into it, and that moment a German sniper takes him out. And I wrote a letter in my column. I said, "Look, anybody that lives at number 2 Bourke Street in Waverley in Sydney, can you please put a candle in the window for Reg and his wife? Because his wife lived out her days there, and he never got home, and she grieved ever after." Anyway, that night, it'd break your heart, a little candle appeared in the window. And that's the story of the death of one man. Hmm. But there were 61,000 Australian soldiers who never came home, exactly like that. That's one story of grieving. And there are families, to a certain extent, that grieve still. But you know, when I put in a story about a man that died in 19 at Gallipoli, and I said, "Well, who was this guy?" I was at Lone Pine Cemetery. Who was this guy that never got back? And a woman wrote to me and said, "I'm the great granddaughter, and when he didn't come home, my great grandmother was left with 3 girls that she couldn't support. They were placed in orphanages. 2 of them were sexually abused. My great grandmother was the one that survived. You know, one died up in Darwin 10 years ago." And you think that was what happened to that family, a fine family of a man and a wife and 3 daughters. He didn't come home. There wasn't enough support. The whole family was torn apart. 2 of the girls sexually abused in an orphanage. And we don't hear those stories. We only hear the story of the noble deaths. And it's just shattering what happened.
We can't imagine. I mean, it's, as a percentage of the population, if we were to do the figures nowadays, it'd be like 500,000 Australians,
That's an interesting point. Well, it was 150. We were a population of give or take 4 million, and we sent away 333,000 went overseas to serve. 151,000 were casualties, took a bullet or shrapnel, and of them, 61,000 were killed. And there's a famous story of what happened in Versailles in 1919, where you had the world's leaders gathered, or the Allies gathered at least. And this story may be apocryphal, but it's recounted again and again. And the story is the issue was on the table at Versailles, many things, but what would happen to the spoils of the losers, which was Germany, and the Axis powers, and there was Germany, New Guinea. Woodrow Wilson, the American president, said, we think in America that Japan, who was one of our allies, should take over New Guinea. Billy Hughes, our prime minister, said, no, Australia should take over New Guinea. And Woodrow Wilson said, Mr. Australian Prime Minister, I represent 220 million Americans. Who do you represent? And Billy Hughes said, I represent 60,000 dead Australians. Mm-hmm. And we will be heard at this table. And he was heard. And for that reason, Australia took over the territory of New Guinea, which proved to be enormously significant in the Second World War. If you think of the Battle of Kokoda, it was all about, you know, who gets to get to Port Moresby. Now imagine if the Japanese had Port Moresby as a Pacific base in that Second World War.
And things may have been very different, you know. I've spoken to someone the other day who says, in history, when we look back on a couple of hundred years' time, they'll possibly look at World War One and World War Two as actually being part of the same war, just with a gap in the middle. I just wanted to come back to something you mentioned before about, because my grandfather fought on the Western Front and
Which battle?
Several of the battles there. He went over as a private and came back as a lieutenant, but he
fought... A lieutenant.
A lieutenant. He fought at Poziers.
Mm-hmm.
And a bullet court as well.
Yep.
But he came back a different man, and you could tell, you could see in his eyes when he was recounting stories of the war, just what a horrific and traumatic experience it was. They talk all about post-traumatic stress these days. If they would have had that diagnosis at the end of World War One, can you imagine what percentage of Australian soldiers would have come back with that?
It's an extraordinary thing, and most of them, I mean, the line at the time was shell shock. But they had no real understanding of what post-traumatic. And the most moving story, you've got down there in Melbourne, Professor Bruce Skates, and I'm a great admirer of his from Monash University. And I was on the Anzac Centenary Commemorative Council and basically advising the government on, you know, how to commemorate this great war. Professor Bruce Skates came up with 100 stories that were emblematic of what happened to 100 Australians in that war. And the most moving story was in the Western Front, at one point at the height of the battle, an Australian soldier came out of the darkness. There's chattering machine guns, there's shells going, and they grab him and they say, who are you, where are you from? He says, dunno. And he says, well, what's your name? Dunno. What's your battalion? Dunno. What's your hometown? Dunno. What's your best mates? Dunno. They don't know. They get him back to Melbourne. They get him to the Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital. Nothing comes to him. They put a note in the Age and the Herald saying, we've had this soldier who doesn't know who he is. 300 families from around Australia said, that's Jack, that's got to be our boy, knew he would live, knew he wasn't missing in action, knew he wasn't killed in action, and they sent representatives to Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital, 300 families, down the hallway, second on your left, they go in, it's not Jack. This goes on for 10 years till they get this, they realise this bloke is a New Zealander, they get him on the ship, his mother meets him at the bottom of the gangplank in Auckland Harbour, Auckland Wharves. Her dearest wishes are come true. It's Jack. He's alive. She wraps her arm around him. He looks at his mother and says, who are you? Yeah. She gets him back to his childhood home. Nothing comes to him. And that's another story. He died, I think, from memory, 1962 in an Auckland mental asylum, as they called them then. And that story, you know, that's, again, emblematic of... That's one of the worst cases of just, you know, the memory banks completely wiped. I mean, a living death, effectively.
I mean, you mentioned before you called yourself a historian rather than a historian.
Just to allow historians, genuine historians, to sneer at me unpleasantly, that's okay.
just to let people know, and the book you've written here, basically it's a chronology of the events of the couple
of
years.
No, it's more than a chronology. What I want to do...
I haven't finished, Peter. It's a chronology, but what you've done is you've made that chronology, written it in present tense, written so so you brought it into the here and now by putting it together from letters and getting to know characters within the book, within your research that you've put through the book, which is a pretty interesting way of doing it. It's great. And I imagine you would have got a lot of favourite characters as you were researching that. You would have been had
got
attached to some of them. I'd love for you to tell us your favourite. Also, that some of them you must have felt a great loss when you discovered what happened to them.
I have wept, you know, like I do that. The my favourite story out of it is Russell Basisto, his name was. And in fact, yes, we're just, again, 4 days past the centenary. But Russell Basisto was a South Australian. And he was the youngest of 6 children, 5 older sisters. And he was a hell of a fighter. He was a great soldier, but he was a hellraiser. And he the line that I use, I mean, it's a W.C. Fields line, I think it is, where he says 98% of his army pay he spent on wine, women and song, and the rest of it he wasted. And he was always in trouble, and he always had venereal disease and all the rest. But anyway, the Battle of Pozieres, he'd been put in the military prison for 2 weeks. They let him out for this particular battle. And just before he goes over the top, he writes to his father and says, "Dad, you know, I'm in trouble here. The only way..." The line was, "The only way to get home to you and Mum and the girls is to go forward. I can't go back." He writes the letter. He goes over the top. He's leading his platoon in the charge for the windmill at Pozieres, and he gets to within 50 yards of the windmill when suddenly there's like a thunderclap, and the guys that are following him, the blokes following him, Russell suddenly disappears. Boz, they called him. Boz just disappears. Anyway, there's an inquiry. They can't find him. The family gets a telegram. "We regret to inform you, your son, Russell Basisto, is missing in action." And they're devastated, but they seize upon missing in action. Not killed in action like the Smithers up the road. Not killed like the Jenkins. Killed in action like the Jenkins family. Our boy's missing in action. There's some chance he's alive. He must have been taken prisoner. And wouldn't it be just like him to come back after the war and not tell us and knock on the door? They live in hope. Nothing happens until 1998. A French farmer, 50 yards down from this old windmill site at Pozieres, after heavy rain, is ploughing his fields. The mud falls away. He looks down and he sees something glinting in the sunlight. And he gets off the tractor, pulls away the mud, and there are the remains, the remarkably well-preserved remains of an Australian soldier. And he calls the gendarmes, and what the silver was the other soldiers that were found, the other soldiers would have a dog tag or identification tag, which was made out of aluminium or tin. And not Russell Basisto, his family had given him like a jeweller's silver dog tag, and it says Private Russell Basisto. Anyway, the gendarmes call the wider authorities. The body is retrieved. The Australian Embassy, the War Graves Commission, the body is retrieved. And they, first of all, they're confused that the dog tag says Private Basisto, but in his pockets he had the tabs of a lieutenant, and they couldn't work out why a private would have the tabs of a lieutenant to put on his shoulders. And then they worked it out, just as Russell Basisto had worked it out when he got to, after leaving Gallipoli, had got to France. He worked out that if you were trying your luck with a French girl on a Saturday night, Private Basisto would struggle. But by God, Lieutenant Basisto did well. He always carried with him the spare tabs of a lieutenant. Anyway, the Howard government, to its everlasting credit, pulled out all stops to bury Russell Basisto. And the most extraordinary thing, there were 250 people at his interment at Courcelles Cemetery when he was laid beneath the sod with the soldiers of his mates that had died that night. But there were four of them still alive. And one of them, I think his name was Alexander Pope from memory, one of them was still alive. He was 102 years old. And there he is at the reinterment of his mate, 82 years after the event. And so they play the bagpipes, they straight, you know, the slow march, and they lay him beneath the turf. And this fellow, his mate from 82 years earlier, goes forward, and he's the first one to lay the first clods of earth on his mate that had died 82 years earlier. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Peter's given us a ring. G'day, Pete.
Interesting point is that one person got shot and then 9 million people died, you know. to do with the First World War, you know, so...
Yeah, now you're referring to Duke Ferdinand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, obviously, everything was, you know, just ready to happen.
It was a powder keg.
And just one person got shot, and then nine million people died. It's an amazing situation that I mean... It seems very disproportionate, doesn't it?
It does seem disproportionate. I mean, we're talking there, Peter, just with Pete on the phone a little bit about how he's suggesting just one person dying, 9 million people died just because of the assassination. I mean, that is used as the reason for the war, but there was a lot more than just that one assassination. There was a big build-up to the First World War, wasn't there, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I the story of Franz Ferdinand and what happened at Sarajevo with Gavrilo Princip is an extraordinary story, but it's like the whole of Europe was a powder keg, and sooner or later it was like a powder keg, you know, filled with vaporous fumes, and the first person that lit a match, the whole thing was going to go. And it's not as if Gavrilo Princip had not killed Franz Ferdinand, assassinated him, the whole thing wasn't going to blow. Sooner or later, at that point, you know, the whole thing was on the edge, and off she went.
I mean, one of the interesting things I find in a parallel here is that the Australians were, in a sense, going over there to fight for the little man and to, you know, fight against the militarism, if you like. And the fact that was the makeup of our army as well, the fact that, you know, they had a healthy disregard for authority, if you like. And,
yes, and they were incarcerated, our blokes, were for military indiscipline, for raising hell on Saturday night, for not saluting, for getting drunk in public, for starting fights in bars. Our blokes were incarcerated. I think that it was like 10 times the level of British soldiers.
It was our forces, though, were a lot more egalitarian than the overseas forces. And in many ways, the world that emerged after World War One was a much more egalitarian world. So.
Yes, it wiped out. I mean, the Kaiser, who had extraordinary authority before that war, he didn't survive the war. He was just before, I think it was on the 8th of November, 3 days before the end of the war, he abdicated. And of course the same happened in Russia. The Tsar was taken out by the Bolsheviks. It was, well, in fact, with the Bolsheviks it became more authoritarian, whereas Germany became initially more democratic until Hitler came along. But it threw all the cards in the air of Europe.
One of the senses I get from your book, from the writings and from, you know, feeling it close up in front and in the now, is the incredible sense of humour of the Australian troops and some of the things, some of the labels that they would give things, some of the lines, you know, in the midst of hell, they're able to find a way to give a few cracking one-liners.
Yes.
It's just amazing.
And that has, you know, all the way through. And again, I work with four or five researchers. One of them I particularly love, we call him Noel the Diary Mole. Dr. Noel Borum, right. who heads down to Canberra and he dives into the archives and he emerges 3 weeks later, you know, with these absolute treasures of letters. And you're right, that wry humour throughout and a capacity to look on the bright side or look on the funny side of things. And I tell you what, the blokes that left Cairo and after Gallipoli. So they, after what happened in Gallipoli, they're evacuated on the last of them, I think, left on the 19th of December 1915, which was an extraordinary exercise in its own right. They get back to Cairo. When they first got to France, I mean, it was the land of milk and honey. They land in Marseille, they get on the train heading north to the Western Front, and they just can't believe it. The exquisite patchwork of farms they're passing through, the snow on the mountains that they can see as they go.
Compared to where they've just been in Egypt,
compared
to
where they've
just
been. And then,
and actually, you get a sense, capture a sense in your book of the fact that they were actually looking forward to it. They were itching to get in to fight.
They were, and you know, the thing that moves me most, so first up is the Battle of Fromelles. They're thrown in. And despite the fact that they are slaughtered, and I use the word advisedly, and had no chance, and I use the phrase advisedly, those who survive, you know, they fought so well, and Pozieres, they fought so well. And the thing, this book that I've just finished, Victory at Villers Bretonneux, when you go forward to March of 1918, the Bolsheviks have taken over in Russia. Lenin's first words are, we're out of this war. It frees it frees the German soldiers that have been on the Eastern Front to come to the Western Front. And suddenly this time, the Germans go over the top, and they take, instead of taking 10 yards a day or 50 yards a day...
They went on the attack with Operation Michael and
Operation
George.
That's right. They take 5 or 6 miles a day, and they're surging forward. The Brits are falling back. They send for the Australians, and this is the extraordinary thing. Again, you talk about stuff that's not understood. The Australians, from the 21st of March to the 29th of April, engaged in 12 actions. And in each action, where there was retreat all around them, the Australians were victorious in all 12 actions and didn't give an inch. And this culminated after the Battle of Villers Bretonneux. You then get to the famous battle, the Battle of Le Hamel, on the, I think it was 4th of July, which was Monash's most famous battle. Yeah, and after the battle, I'll say this quick, because I know you're going to cut me off, Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, asks to see the Australians. He travels to Le Hamel. They form up before him, and he says these words. I'm paraphrasing, but he says, "Tomorrow," because Georges Clemenceau says to the Australians, "tomorrow I will return to my people. I will tell them I have seen the Australians. I have looked in their eyes. When you came to this continent, we knew you would fight. We knew you were men who would leave your homes to fight for liberty. We had no idea. You have astonished a nation." And it really is. I mean, it brings a tear to my eye. You go to Le Hamel, you see those words up on the wall. The war was slaughter. The war was useless. The war was devastating, but if you want to talk about blokes who would fight, our blokes would fight, and they did fight.
Yeah, well, you know, their flanks are falling apart, they're still holding their ground. It is an incredible story of Australian resilience. G'day, Mark.
I just wanted to mention that, I'll turn the speaker off, that my grandfather died on the 5th of August at Pozieres, which was 1 week ago, and he'd fought in the Boer War as well with the Queensland Bushmen's Regiment, I think it was. But, my mother was born a week after he died, and it's always
she never got to meet
sad
him.
To think that that he never got to see his daughter, my mother.
That's very sad, and as you say, Peter, there's lots of stories like that. I mean, it was such a long front, 500 miles of front, with the battles right along it. There's just so many stories from the First World War. And maybe that's why it's taking so long for the Western Front to become known,
well,
Peter.
And the thing is, the Germans have those same stories. You know, they're useless slaughter, and yet in that First World War, there was great respect between the Australian soldiers and the German soldiers. You know, and equally just devastating stories.
Yeah, look, actually got a text here, says, "Where can I get a copy of Peter's book from? I have Kokoda and Gallipoli books and would love this one as well."
Any good bookstore near you.
You'll be able to pick it up, I reckon. Peter, it's been lovely talking to you, as it always is. And, you know, well done on your book. And it's great to, as you say, it's history, but it's stories of history put together in the here and now.
Thank you.
Lest we forget. That's well said, Peter. Peter Fitzsimons there, the author of a book called From Els and Pozieres in the Trenches of Hell on ABC Local Radio.